History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there, maybe down the street, maybe around the corner, perhaps even right next door. Stories most of us can't even really comprehend, but when we take the time to listen to them, we are really thankful we did. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we gain so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You might recall a couple months ago all the attention paid to the 75th anniversary, rightfully so, of the D-Day landings. Even here on Hometown Heroes, we went back in the archives to hear from so many veterans who had been a part of that massive operation. Come December, I'm sure you're going to be hearing a lot about the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. And before that, you might even hear mention in the Netherlands of 75 years since Operation Market Garden. But one element of the war in Europe three quarters of a century ago that really ends up overlooked quite often will be the focus of our program today. It was initially planned to coincide with the Normandy landings, but didn't take place until August 1944. If you happened to be at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. on August 15th, you would have caught a ceremony marking the 75th anniversary of the launch of Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France, carried out by many of the same men who had participated in Normandy, others who had endured fierce fighting in Italy, and many who would go on to experience those brutal conditions of the Battle of the Bulge. Approximately 200,000 Allied troops participated in Operation Dragoon, which was in its early stages of success 75 years ago this week. Some of those men have shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes over the years, and we're going to put them together into a bit of a mosaic for you today in honor of that 75th anniversary. By the end of this hour, we will have heard from five different veterans representing a combined five Purple Hearts. But we're going to start with a guy making his very first combat jump as a paratrooper at the start of that invasion. Walter Fees passed away in 2016, a couple years after this veteran of the 517th Parachute Infantry Regimental Combat Team shared with us his firsthand experience in Operation Dragoon.
We went in at night. We loaded up about 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. We went across the Caspian Sea over by Nice, France, and then 15 miles into France. And there's two ridges there going this way. And they're like, maybe 40, 50 miles across there. They were over 2,000 feet to go across these ridges. And then the planes were supposed to come in from the right like this and drop over and come down to 600 feet and jump us and then climb up and go out on the other side. But the Air Corps got scared. And when they come across those peaks, they just leveled off across there and jumped us more than 2,000 feet in the air. But before that, when we came in on the coast, man, that flak was something else. And I'm sitting there like this, and planes right over like this, about that far, and a big old piece of shrapnel comes through here, right out the other side. And I said, oh, Jesus, I'm going to get out of here.
So you're on a C-47?
C-47, yes, we had the one door.
So you're waiting in there to jump, and shrapnel comes within a foot or two of you?
Yeah, above my head here. I said, Jesus, I need to get out of here. And I could not wait. And I jumped, and I'm floating down through there, and I look down there, and there's the fog below us. And it looked like when they invaded Sicily, they had dumped two plane loads of paratroopers into the ocean. And so I looked down there and saw that fog, and so I grabbed my T5 pack. You got a T5 pack here, and you turn it, open it, and it drops. And then you just put your arms straight down like this and hold yourself in the chute. And then when you get within 15, 20 feet of the water, you throw your arm straight up, and the chute goes off that way, and you go straight down. Because if you go straight down with that chute, it'll take you under, and you never get up. So I'm all ready to do that, and all of a sudden, I just sat down. I didn't even fall. I sat down in a plowed grape vineyard, where it was all plowed up in the middle, you know? Yeah. I just sat down on it and never even fell down. And so that's the kind of luck I had.
So you're expecting a splash that never came, huh?
Splash never came. So then Bob Rock was there. Me and Bob Rock, we were both big guys. Bob Rock was 6'2". They put me and him in the back of the stick. You know what a stick is. It's 16 men, and you go out the door. And they put me and Bob Rock back there. And whenever that green light come on, we just started going forward and pushing just as hard as we could because we wanted to get out fast. And so Bob Rock was riding back of me, and I get to looking around for him. I holler, Bob, where are you? And I'm up here on the hill. He's on the hill, you know. And
this is in the middle of the night. It's all dark.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's 5 minutes to five in the morning when we jumped. So Bob Rock's hollering. We're hollering back and forth. And all of a sudden, I hear shh, 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 going through the air. And I see these tracers going about 50 feet above us. And it's a German machine gun over there shooting at us, but he just didn't know what the hell he was doing. And so Bob come down off of there, and the side of his face was all bloody from hitting a tree and everything. And there, I hit that right in between the vineyard and never even fell down. So that's just the luck I had. I was lucky all the way.
And this is something that's always fascinated me with all the paratroopers I've spoken with, is jumping is nerve-wracking enough. Then you get on the ground. Yeah. And you got to figure out where in the world you are and where the enemy is.
Well, we had the compass. During training, they had taken us to Tennessee and dreamt us in the middle of Tennessee with nothing but our compasses on and a list of readings to go by. It was a three-day trick to get to Cookeville, Tennessee. And we were back out in those mountains, so we learned in the States how to do that. We know we wanted to go south to go straight to the ocean to meet those Germans coming up. See, we're 15 miles in. That's what they do with the paratroopers. You jump way back there, and you form your line and everything. Then the ships come on the shore in the morning at day of the bridge break and start pushing them back. And then when the Germans come back over that hill, there we were waiting for them. Man, about noon, that big old cut over there, and a big old cut like this over there. Looked over there, and that highway was just solid with trucks coming and looked like ants all over that hill where the Germans were coming. But just before that, Carl Salmon, our sniper, had went over there sniping them and everything. And about an hour later, the Jeep comes back with Carl laying on top of the hood with a bullet between his eyes. So, you know. Just nothing, everything to shake you up. So here, we look over there, and all them Germans are coming. And then we look up above us, and there's these funny-looking planes circling over us. See, there was 5,000 us, 5,000 British. These planes were circling over us, and so they're going to bomb us. Anyway, they circled over us, and here they went, over there bombing those Germans. And it was that British Mosquito Light bomber they had. And there were six of them, and they just bombed hell out of those guys over there. We're up on a hill covering a big grape vineyard, I mean like 2,000 acres or so. And all of a sudden, we looked out through there, and that whole grape vineyard was moving where the Germans were coming through it. And so we're laying up there. I'm popping my mortar right and left and everything. And then all of a sudden, vineyard just started disappearing from down at the other end all the way up through there. And it was the 442 up above us that Japanese American boys setting up there with their 4.2 mortars, and they just demolished that vineyard and all of them Germans in there. I went out through there, and there was over 200 of them dead in there, and it was those boys. So later on, whenever we left and went back, I go up through there, and there's the gliders that they came in on, and one of them was sitting like this up in the air, and there was 16 bodies laying under it with parachutes on them. Anybody got killed, you covered them with their parachute. There were 16 of them laying there under the edge of that glider. But the 442, they were something else.
Well, and we've spoken to some of those 442nd Regimental Combat Team vets on this program, the guys whose families, for the most part, were in internment camps, and here they are risking their lives and, in many cases, giving their lives overseas. It sounds like you're saying that you're not sure you'd be here without the 442nd.
No, we wouldn't have been, because they had sneaked in back there in them gliders. See, I came in the first wave, which is one reason why I'm still here. It was dark. And we landed for anybody could even see us and everything. And then the third and fourth wave of the paratroopers coming in, they got hell shot out of them. And then the gliders came in with them. When they jumped, they jump out, and the gliders are towing that back of them. They turn the gliders loose, and they come down. So they brought them 442 in by gliders. And I know they must have had high casualties, too. I got nothing but good to say about the 442. They're a fine group of young men, American men.
Amen. Well, and just hearing you describe all this, I can tell how real this all still is and how clear your memory is, and you're painting a powerful picture for the rest of us. So you'd been in Italy. Now here you are fighting the Germans in southern France. But you weren't quite done yet, huh?
No, we started back up through there, across the hills and into a valley over there, and and I go down by this house, and I'm setting up my mortar there, and I look over on, across there about a mile, and there's a convoy of German trucks going up the other side of the river up through that little town. So I set up my mortar, and I started blasting hell out of them trucks. And I look up, and here's six guys all dressed in black with armbands on, with dirty clothes on and everything, and carrying weapons on slings and everything, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They had been in there helping us, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They all came up and hugged us. That was nice.
Some people might not know what that means, what you're talking about.
Well, the Mach-E is the French resistance, and they were tough. They were tough boys. They hated the Germans so bad that it was far worse than we did, probably, because they had killed their women and everything, you know. They were just hugging us and everything. We give them grenades and all that kind of stuff.
So here you are. You're 20 years old. You fought your way through Italy and jumped behind enemy lines into southern France. And yet, now you look back and say, man, the Battle of the Bulge hadn't even happened yet.
Down there in southern France, we turned to the right, went up these hills, these twisted roads that the trucks had to pull forward and back up, go around the turn and everything, up to the top of the Alps Maritimes. And we tangled with the Germans up there. One morning, they took me down about 4 or 5 miles down this road and set me up on a little crossroads there and said, now there's about 50 Germans out there laying mines, and we got to stop them. And so my observer says, drop one in and go about 3,000 yards. So I dropped it in and went 3,000 yards. And he says, now bring it back about 150 yards and get it on this side. And then if they don't give up, you drop one in the middle. So I said, the hell with this. I dropped it back 50 yards and dropped it in. And it was over. Killed three of them. The rest of them gave up, and they came up through there. And you would not believe that they were ragged, dirty kids, about anywhere from 17 to 19 years old, maybe even 16, in the German army, forced in there. And they had them out there. Man, they were crying and everything else. Scared the hell out of them. So, and then right after that, they brought us down off of that hill, and we got on the 40-8s and started towards Lille, France, for a 14-week vacation, which never materialized because of the Battle of the Bulge.
And not only would he end up in the Battle of the Bulge, he would have to survive 9 days being surrounded by German forces there. Since our focus today is the invasion of southern France and that 75th anniversary, we're not going to get into the rest of his experiences in the war today, but you can, of course, listen to that complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. There were some pretty close calls, of course, and like so many other veterans, the lingering effects of all those intense life-or-death moments were something he had to try to overcome.
One experience, me and my wife were sleeping in bed flat on our backs. She was beside me, and I wake up, and she's shaking me. She said, what the hell are you doing? And I was laying there fighting Germans on a dam, and my arm was coming up and down like this, hitting her, and she woke me up. So that's the way it was. You dreamt. For many months, you dreamt. Every night. Yeah, it doesn't go away that fast, you know?
I know it's not easy to talk about those things, but I think it's important for the rest of us to understand that this isn't something you left over there. It's something you've had to carry with you.
Yeah, for 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 or 4, maybe. And then I got busy working in the oil fields and raising kids, and you know, it just goes away slow.
And he was still working in the oil business when he shared his story here on the radio at age 90. That is the late Walter Fees from the 517th Parachute Infantry Regimental Combat Team, whose participation in the invasion of southern France 75 years ago came by jumping behind enemy lines. As for those who came ashore on the beaches of southern France, many have shared that that element of Operation Dragoon was a bit of a break compared to the other situations they've been through. The main invasion force was comprised of the 3rd Infantry Division, the 36th Infantry Division, and the 45th Infantry Division. Rex Rainey served with the 45th. And for a soldier that would end up in combat for more than 500 days, Operation Dragoon, on the heels of intense fighting in Italy, really did feel more comfortable by comparison.
From above Rome, then we went back to Naples and boarded ships and went to southern France for the invasion of southern France. That was the best one we had ever made.
The cleanest?
And we lost no men on it. We had lost one boat in Sicily. We didn't lose any at Salerno, but we went in and to an old farm kid, southern France was beautiful country.
I bet.
We didn't hit too much opposition for the most part, and so to speak, it was a paradise.
He even marked his 23rd birthday during the invasion of southern France, but some things he would witness a little later on were on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from paradise. And I think that's one thing that is really important to consider about the invasion of southern France. It progressed so rapidly and in concert with the forces that were continuing across the continent from Normandy. For example, Paris was liberated on August 29th, and that'll be the next 75th anniversary marked at the National World War II Memorial. But that pace really was important. Maybe it sounds a little obvious to say that every day the war was shortened meant lives were being saved, but Rex Rainey had a very compelling example of that when months later he ended up at the Dachau concentration camp in Germany.
Bunch of railroad cars, and we first looked at them, and there were bodies in stock cars and in gondolas and along the tracks and between them and hanging out of them. And it's something you never expected to see. We didn't like what we saw. They had the crematorium, the big gas furnace going, and there was bodies piled up like cordwood that they had been, I guess, thrown in. We were about an hour after the camp was entered before we got in there. I don't think we had an hour before we was ready to go back.
Did you see any of the survivors of the
camp?
Oh,
yes. Yes, they would come and try to claw on you, get you to take them out. But they were walking skin and bones. I didn't see near all of them, but yes, I saw probably, I don't know, 50 or 100.
You saw enough to get a feel for what had happened there and what kind of
too much
cruelty people were capable of.
I'd hate to tell you how many people were dead or dying in stock cars, in gondolas. Some of them were half in and half out of a train, couldn't move anymore. No, you can't imagine. I can't imagine what it was like, really. And I spent about an hour there.
Yeah. And did, maybe not in the moment, but eventually did that experience and your coming face to face with that give you maybe even a new understanding or appreciation for how important the work that you'd been doing over there was?
It made you do a little thinking. It made you willing to travel to Denver when that Colonel Sparks arranged for a marker in remembrance of the Holocaust.
Rex Rainey passed away last year at the age of 96, but his story bears witness to what it was that the Allied victory put a stop to. You can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, and there's much more to come as we mark 75 years since the often overlooked but highly effective invasion of southern France. Still to come, the perspective of a glider pilot, a prisoner of war, and more. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of the 75th anniversary of Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France, which started in mid-August 1944. Many of the glider pilots who had survived their one-way missions behind enemy lines a couple months earlier in Normandy were flying again for southern France, and that included Brooklyn, New York native Mel Pliner with the 436th Troop Carrier Squadron.
We were flown down to the northern coast of North Africa in a C-54, about 20 other glider pilots, myself. We landed at an air base down there and refueled, and the C-54 then flew up the east coast of Italy to a town of Certavizia,
all right,
where they had carved out an airstrip, a dirt airstrip, and they had brought in some Waco gliders. Okay. After the Normandy invasion, those of us that survived and flew horse and gliders went to the commanding officer and told him, look, Colonel, we trained in the American Waco gliders. Let the Limeys fly their glider. And we never flew a horse again.
Uh-huh.
And he understood. Now, I'm fortunate that I did fly the horse and glider on D+1, because if I had been assigned a Waco on D-Day in a night mission, I might not be here.
Very true, because you know what happened to so many of those guys who did.
So many guys. It was a night mission.
Not to mention the guys they were carrying. So many of them were killed, too.
Right.
So you guys now are in Italy, and you're going to be flying
CG-4.
Now
we're up to this airstrip near the little town of Certavizia. They bring on more troops, jeeps, jeep trailers, and so forth and so on. We, the glider pilots, and I guess the rest of the cooks and the bakers also, are in a tent area that's just a little bit below the airstrip, and we're sleeping in cots. And one night comes a hell of a rainstorm, and all the rainwater comes down into the tent area. When I wake up in the morning, my B4 bag is floating. Water is right up to the bottom of my cot. Everything else is floating. So there's no point in putting on shoes and socks. We're all walking around barefoot. Did that for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 days. Water drained off. Sun came out and dried up the mud. All you could see was footprints in the mud. Okay. Dried up. It got cleaned up, washed out, and so got back to normal. And I was assigned a Waco glider with a 75-millimeter howitzer, 3 troops, 10 rounds of ammunition. Now, reconnaissance photos showed that the town of Lemuy, L-E-M-U-Y, about maybe 25 miles inland from the southern coast of France.
Yeah, so this is the southern France invasion.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Just off to the right, there was a big clump of trees in the formation of the letter C. And when we were briefed, they showed this on the screen. It said, when you see that letter C, that's the area that we want the gliders to land in, because we're behind enemy lines.
Of course.
We get into the glider, hooked up, take off, and we start to go north to the coast. And I notice the formation up front does a turn to the right. 15 minutes later, do another turn to the right. I think, well, mission's been aborted, canceled. 15 minutes later, do another turn to the right. Another 15 minutes, take another turn to the right. And the formation now headed back to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Reason being that when we were supposed to land up there, the place was covered with fog. So they had to kill an hour.
Uh-huh.
15, 15, 15. We
made
an hour later,
yep,
we're heading back up. Okay, we get over the coast. I see the big letter C. I see the town of Lemuy. And I get the red light, the green light. And I cut loose. And here, now this is wine country. They're growing grapes.
Mm-hmm.
I see a field. It's a vineyard. And they've got the posts every so often with the wire going on and the grapevines on the wire. I come in and land on the top of this grapevines. And as I'm doing that, I'm just knocking down the posts. But the wire is taking the fabric out from under my glider. Made a good landing. I got out. 3 troops get out. Ahead of us and off to the left is a farmhouse, 2 stories, with shutters. On the bottom, the 3 windows, the shutters are closed. On the second story, the end shutters are closed, but the middle one is open, and it's dark, and we start to draw rifle fire.
we can see the fire. Get out, get in the side here, hot, eating grapes. Wasn't very long after that, another glider comes in and lands between my glider and the house.
Mm-hmm.
13 troops, pilot. They get out, come over on my side. The sergeant in charge says, Lieutenant, we got a bigger gun than they got. Why don't we get it out? That's a good idea. You guys all concentrate on your fire on that middle window. Open the nose, and we roll out the howitzer. The sergeant takes open the breech, bore sights it, gets around, puts it in, closes the breech, and says, anytime, Lieutenant, out come three krauts. They could see that howitzer. We go blow them out of the foot. So they decided to give up. About that time, the troops here take over the krauts. All right, I know where the farmhouse was where we flew over, where the troops had taken over and made a headquarters. I figure, well, got to get back there and check in and tell them where my glider is with a howitzer. So I'm walking along this dirt road. I come upon a little Fiat automobile. It's in the ditch. So I figure, well, hell, a glider pilot would rather ride than walk. I'll check this out. Booby traps. So I went over to the field where the paratroopers had landed, took my knife and I cut some shroud lines, went back there and tied the shroud line to the door handle, and I went around the back and I pulled it and opened the door. Nothing happened.
You were bracing for an explosion. It didn't happen.
I was thinking it might be booby trapped.
Sure.
I don't know.
A lot of things were.
Evidently, it wasn't. Door was open. Walked over there and I looked inside. I didn't see the booby traps. So I got inside. It's got the ignition and the keys. It starts right up.
But it's still sideways in the ditch.
I can't get out of the ditch. Along comes Jeep.
Yeah.
I stop him. I say, hey, guys, help me get this thing out of the ditch. No problem, Lieutenant. So we hook up a chain, pull it up. They said, now, if you guys would give me about a gallon of gas out of your jerry can, I'd appreciate it. No problem. Put in a gallon of gas. I look at the gauge, half a tank. Now, something like that ought to get at least 30 miles to the gallon. So I drove this thing up to headquarters, told them where my glider was, and I told them I got this little Fiat automobile. You think it'll tow a howitzer? I said, only one way to find out. Well, okay, go back to your glider and bring that howitzer back to headquarters. So I go back to the glider. The three guys are still standing there. I said, okay, guys, let's hook this thing up to this little car. By the time we're bouncing around in sand and pushing it, we finally get it up on the road. The guys get in the car, and we drive up to headquarters. I said, where do you want it? He said, no, just leave it anywhere. So I dropped it there. About that time, other glider pilots had checked in, and they were off to the side somewheres, and they had a pot that was, they were cooking something in. So when I went over there, I said, hey, what's cooking? He said, what do you got to put in it? He said, come with me. In the back of this Fiat, I had found, now, it didn't have a trunk like our cars. You got to pull the back of the back seat forward. Case of French wine. With the bottles with the corks on it, the wire over it, you know.
Right, to release it. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Look at that. It says, you're in. Well, needless to say, after we passed out.
You had some French wine.
We get up the next morning. I'd like to go into the town of Lamoille and see what it's like. Well, the town of Lamoille is laid out like a wagon wheel. The hub is the church with the steeple, and the spokes are streets. We drive into the town, and we get about a couple of blocks from the steeple. We start to draw rifle fire, stop the car, and then we get out into the doorways. I said, tell you what, let's concentrate our fire on the bell. Bing, bing, bing. After we've been firing at it for about 3 or 4 minutes, out come two krauts. Can you imagine being up in the tower next to that bell and we're bing, bing, bing. They gave up. Well, when they came down, the town came alive and they were going to kill him. Now I said, no, hold on. It wasn't long after that the seaborne forces had come up from the beach in their trucks and equipment, jeeps and stuff like that. And they took care of the krauts. We decided to go back to base, to our headquarters, get our gear, and head down to the beach. And I asked the swabby down there who's in charge. He said, Lieutenant over there. I drove up to Lieutenant. I said, Lieutenant, if you get us on the next boat out of here, you can have this car. He says, you see all the cars and trucks against the seawall? All mine. I wasn't the only one.
Uh-huh.
Well, we got on a boat over to the island where C-47s were in different squadrons waiting to take the glider pilots, those that survived. And we waited a while, took us back to our base. Well, we got back to base, and after the glider pilots made it back that survived, and we knew who made it and who didn't, because we knew how many of the glider pilots from our squadron flew in and how many came back. We got back on the C-54 and went back to England, and that was the Southern France invasion.
But we never would have heard that Southern France story from Mel if he had not survived a couple more glider missions, first in the Netherlands as part of Operation Market Garden, then in Operation Varsity along the Rhine River, a mission that would leave him with the Purple Heart.
This time, I had 13 troops, and I was assigned a co-pilot that was a washed-out cadet. He didn't make it in power pilot, so he transferred to the glider program. Mm-hmm. He had about 2 hours flight time. Never been in combat.
Uh-huh.
Came time to take off, and we're waiting in line, and one of the troops fired a rifle. They're holding a rifle like that.
Yeah.
And he pulled the trigger, fired a round. I got out of my seat to check to see if he'd have cut any of my control wires, my control cables. Fortunately, he didn't. I said, you guys, put your rifles on safe, all of you, which they did. Okay. Came time we took off. This time, we're going for the Rhine invasion. Get into formation of echelon four to right. Okay, we get ready to approach the Rhine River, drop down to 500. As we cross the river, I couldn't see the Weitzel, but before we took off, I was assigned a bazooka, and my co-pilot had a vest, three rockets in front, three rockets behind for the bazooka.
Right.
We were going to land close to a main intersection highway where we were supposed to join other troops to set up a defense to keep any resupplies from getting to the troops.
Right.
In the front line.
Cutting their supply line.
Cross the Rhine, drop down, green light, red light, and I cut loose. And here's a big field. I don't know how many acres. Big power lines with the high towers across the field and gliders. Some of them hit the wires. So I figured, well, okay, I cut loose. And I'm heading for that. And I got a place where there's room for me to land my glider. I'm 200 feet high, and I'm holding the wheel like this, and some krauts, a bird shooter. Now, you know, most of the krauts were aiming at the pilot's compartment, and it was going to the tail section. This guy's a bird shooter. You know how you lead birds?
Yeah.
He was the bird shooter. I'm sitting like that, and he gets me right through the arm between the radius and the other.
Still have a scar.
See
there?
See that?
Uh-huh.
That's where it came out.
Oh.
I said, take over, I'm hit.
So this is your co-pilot who's never done this before.
He froze.
Can't function.
I pull up the spoiler and held it up with my left foot, and I landed it with my left hand and my right foot.
Because your right hand, you can't do anything
my
with.
My right hand
hit.
Fell down.
It's
out
useless.
Into shock.
So you're landing this glider one-handed.
One hand and one foot. Of course, I was only about 200 feet high. When I did that, evidently, I took and wiped out the gear on my right side. Just came right off. Because over there, the fields, about every 15 furrows was a deep one to carry any moisture off the field instead of washing the grass off over to a ravine, a little ravine over there. Came to stop with the left wheel in the ravine and my right wing about a foot or two above the ground. By that time, all the troops had gotten out, and my co-pilot came to life, and he got out. I had on a flak vest. Now, a flak vest, it's got two snaps on each shoulder.
Right.
And it's got a belt around the waist with snaps. Supposed to be able to give it one good jerk, and it's supposed to fall off.
Right.
Well, with my arm in shock, I'm pulling with my left hand, and it didn't come off. And I got scared, because with that thing on, you don't move very well.
It's heavy.
I gave it a second pull, and it came off. And I got out and got underneath. Spurt.
This wound in your arm is spraying blood everywhere.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I get out my first aid kit.
Because you're all alone. Everybody else is left.
Got out, put a bandage, I put it around here to stop the bleeding.
Uh-huh. You had to give yourself first aid.
Yeah. About 30, 40 minutes, my co-pilot is lying on there. And this guy, he wants to get up and run. I says, hell, you wouldn't run 15, 20 feet and they'd shoot you. Because there was still a lot of rifle fire. But it wasn't too long after our troops started to take over. And the rifle fire started to just about quiet down. Shortly after that, a squad of American troops was crossing the field. I said, now's the time to get up and get in the middle of it. And we started yelling and screaming. And about 13 troops turned around with their rifles. American troops, hey, guy! Showed them the American flag on our shoulder. And we got in the middle of them. We got down to the ravine there, and there were other glider pilots there, troops. And there was a first aid guy. Mm-hmm. He saw I had this. He's, what happened to you? I said, I got one through the arm. He said, let me take a look. Took a look at it, put some sulfur, whatever it was, wrapped it, gave me a sling. He said, how does it feel? I said, hurts like hell. He says, here's a morphine syringe. Stick it in your arm. And he says, it'll keep you from hurting, slow you down. I says, I don't want it. If I got to move out, I want to be able to move out. Mm-hmm. Which we did.
And of course, he made it back to share that story with us. You can link to that complete original interview as well at hometownheroesradio.com. For us here on the radio, it's time for another break. And when we come back, two veterans from the 36th Infantry Division, a driving force in the success of Operation Dragoon 75 years ago. One became a prisoner, another was saved in one of World War II's most legendary rescues. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, drawing attention to a part of World War II that doesn't seem to get as much attention as some more well-known European operations before and after. I'm talking about Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France unfolding 75 years ago this week. Over 7,000 Americans were killed during that effort, thousands more wounded, and many of those casualties came from the 36th Infantry Division, which by that time had already been through fighting in North Africa and had suffered incredibly heavy casualties in Italy. Pasquale Reyes had made it through those campaigns, made the landing in southern France, and it was during that effort that he would become a prisoner of war.
They captured me because we were in two buildings. I was in one building and they were in the... The majority of the guys were in this big building. And then to the right was a forest. And to the back of them, there was forest. And I told them, we're going to be down there. And you guys start going down. It's going to start raining. It's getting dark, dark. We'll engage the guys, the enemy. We'll engage them for a while. Then we're going to start running back over there that way. About that time, this jeep comes in. And they were shooting all over, but they didn't get him. He was a captain. We told him to get the hell out to the back, to run over to our forest. We started engaging the enemy. Well, of course, you know, just a little while, somebody in English, told us, you Americans better give up now. You haven't got a chance. Plain English, good English. Then he talked to us in Spanish, and he told us, you know, that we didn't have a chance in Spanish. I said, what the hell is this? About that time, a big tank comes, stays over there. So what we did, we gave up. But the rest of the guys had taken off. They escaped, some of them, but some of them were still captured.
How many were there in the group that you were in that were captured there?
Oh, about 5 or 7, something like that.
But you knew you guys were outnumbered and surrounded.
Oh, yeah. With that tank, if we would have done a couple of shots, that tank would have blown us up. I wouldn't be here. So I told the guys, what's up to you? I'll leave it up to you. You want to keep on or you want to give up now? I said, there's no chance. Remember, the tank is up there. We haven't got a chance.
Well, and before you got captured, you were wounded. What happened there? Tell me about it.
Well, what happened is that I got wounded, I don't know if it was a bullet or a piece of that stuff, but hit my butt. You know, most of the time you get hit in the butt, and I did. I couldn't walk very much. I couldn't run that much. Then they wanted me to carry a German when I got captured because I couldn't move very much.
Because you got captured not long after you're wounded, yeah. Your left side is still in a lot of pain?
Yeah. They got me real bad, you know, and I couldn't move. I didn't want to shoot because, I couldn't move. I knew that if I shot, I was going to be killed because I couldn't run and hide behind the trees and all that. So like the German said, just throw your rifle out. It'll be clear.
Well, maybe you can walk us through what it was like from there, because I'm sure you had no idea what to expect when you're going to be a prisoner.
I didn't expect nothing. I knew that I was captured. I didn't know if I was going to be killed because they told us, you know, that be careful because some of these Germans are very handy with their rifles or pistols. And they don't care. They'll knock the hell out of you. But they captured me and they took me to a barn because it started raining. Some of us, they didn't keep us together because we were quite a bit of us, about 200, I think. They had a lot of hay. And some of these Germans were resting inside the barn. Why fight it? There's nothing for me to do right now. I went to sleep. In the morning, they marched us to this place, prison place. Before they did that, they interviewed us and all that. He was a mean little guy. You know, all we said were like, everybody, your name, rank, and serial number. And we stuck with it. And we stuck with it, period. They wanted to know how many divisions or what company and all that. We didn't say nothing. Slapped the hell out of us.
Wait, I want to make sure people hear that. You said they slapped you.
Oh, yes. They slapped us a couple of times. They did that because they were trying to hurt us, to scare us, see if we would talk, see? I knew that. So they sent me to a prison camp where I met the rest of the guys, and they were aviators. And they I talked with this young aviator, and he told me, he said, I was wounded, and my plane came down, and I got hurt. But they took care of me here in the hospital. You'd be imagined, doctors there, German doctors, good doctors that took care of the people. Anyway, we were in that camp, and the Nazis would come around in the car, and they would go through the camp. Check everybody out, make everybody stand out. Then they would send out the dogs in there to all the buildings. They were looking for a radio. These guys, these engineers, we picked up what they told us to pick, and they made a radio. And they had it there and right in the kitchen. There was a post there, a wooden post. And I don't know, this guy was very smart. He dug a little thing, and they had that thing in there.
He hollowed out part of the post to hide the radio inside?
Yeah.
And the Germans never found it?
Never found it.
And that was your connection to the outside world?
Yeah, we used to hear British broadcasting, and they would tell us exactly how far our people were. So we were just taking it easy in prison. We didn't do nothing to arise the Germans. That's the way we kept it.
What was the hardest thing for you about being a prisoner?
The hardest thing for me to be a prisoner was that I was a prisoner in the first place, and I couldn't move. I escaped twice from a work detail, but I didn't know which way to go. So I got into the work detail. Going back, somebody told me which way to go. But then when I went out again from this work detail, this Puerto Rican went with me. I didn't care for it, and nobody to go with me. And this Puerto Rican, he was in a tree, and this kid seen him. And this, so stupid, killed a kid. But by that time, I swung out of there and went back straight off and went into the work detail. And I was scared then because they were all police and the Germans were all over. They found this guy. They killed him. Oh, I said, no, I ain't going to go out no more. I'm liable to get caught and killed, you know.
So you had been out on a work detail and snuck off by yourself? You're all alone?
Yeah.
But because you didn't know which way to go, when you saw that crew again, you joined back up?
Yeah, I went back. They told me which way to go if I wanted to leave. I said, no, I'm not going to leave no more. You know, I'm not going to take no chances like that. Because they get me, I'll be shot right there.
And you knew that because you saw that happen to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
While you were in the prison camp,
You had another bout of malaria?
Yes, I got another heavy malaria. I was sick. I thought I was going to die because I had been, you know, the food wasn't that good. And then you're weak, very weak. There were some British soldiers there, and they kept me going, wetting my lips and giving me a little water because I would get sick if I drink a lot of it, just a little bit. I would feel okay. And I don't know where the hell they found out those Erbine pills or whatever you call them, those yellow pills, and they gave me some. The malaria started easing off. After that, they gave me another two pills, and before I know it, I didn't have no more malaria. And I could drink a little bit more water. That's the way I went, with a little bit more water every day. That's the way I went until I got Patton came in.
Those fellow prisoners of yours, those British guys, they really did save your life.
Yeah, they did. You know, I looked for their names. I wanted to know their names, and I could never find them. Never.
Of course, he would have thanked them profusely if he had. And another man he has great gratitude for is General George Patton, who made a grand entrance as part of the liberation of Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany, where Pasquale's time as a prisoner came to an end.
General Patton coming in, you know, he's a rough and a bad mouth, everybody. You know. Oh, man, you see him like... He was the greatest in this world. He said, I would say he was my angel, my guardian angel. And the guy came through that camp, and he said, bring out all those Germans out of here, because the Germans were hiding, you know. They had to come out, all of them. Boy, he went around and cussed the hell out of them, and he said, you know, he was going to kill each and every one of them. You know, he said he was bad mouth, you know. He got in his jeep again, you know. Here we go. But I was so happy, like something had been lifted off my shoulders. That man was tough, but he was a gentle giant.
So that's the perspective of one 36th Infantry Division veteran captured during the Southern France campaign. He was in the 142nd Regiment, while Al Tortolano was in the 141st. If you happened to visit American Legion Post 419 in Santa Clara, California, you would find that, as of about 6 months ago now, it carries the name of Al Tortolano, who 75 years ago this week was about to be wounded for the second time.
We had come off a battle, and we got pulled back for a rest. After about 3 days, we found that there were some of our men were wounded up on this hill, and they asked for volunteers to go up and get them out. You know, it's like stretcher bearers, litter bearers. So we went up there, and we were told to follow these cabled communication lines, then that would take us to the area where the wounded were. Well, somehow we followed the lines, but they took us on the wrong side of the hill. The wounded were on this side of the hill, we're on the other, and the Germans are on another hill looking right down our throats, and we started getting mortar fire. And there were six of us walking in a line, and a mortar hit right close by. And the guy behind me, two guys away from me, one of them got killed. The lead man got killed. I must have been blown up off about 3 or 4 feet off the ground. And so I became one of the guys that had to be carried off the hill. And I don't know how I made it, because when I got to the aid station where they took care of us, when they showed me the blanket that I had under my arm that we were going to use to cover the wounded with, they opened it up. It was loaded full of holes with shrapnel. So I got shrapnel there. I had some shrapnel here and a couple of pieces in my throat.
So in your midsection and your throat all over the place, and you had to be in pain and wondering if you're going to make it.
Well, I didn't know. They say I was out for 3 days. So I really didn't know anything until I came to in the on a third day. And But they said everything was okay. My, you know, except for the concussion and stuff, they said I was all right. So they kept me another day. I think I was there altogether 5 days. And then they said that I was well enough to go back to my outfit.
But from the moment that shell hit to you coming to in the aid station, 3 days worth of life, you don't remember anything between that time?
Nope. I don't know what happened while I was there.
And they said you were fine to go back to the lines. Did you feel like you were ready to go back to the lines?
No, but I knew I had to go back. And the funny part, well, they were going to put me in the nearest outfit. And I said, no way. I said, I'm going. I want to go back to my own outfit. Because even though we kept losing men, there were still, you know, guys that I knew. And I didn't want to go in with a group of strangers. So I found my own way back to where the 36th Division was.
And that insistence to rejoin his unit would almost cost him his life. Al ended up as part of what has become known as the Lost Battalion, cut off and surrounded by German forces. Come October, I'm sure you'll be hearing a lot about that 75th anniversary and the courageous men who saved Al and more than 200 others at a very heavy cost. Those rescuers were the go-for-broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
2nd Battalion had tried getting us out, and they couldn't do it. And the American, whatever American troops they sent in, they got beat back. They just couldn't break through. And so it got to the point that I think it was on the fifth day when Erwin Blonder and his Captain Martin, I think his name was, he was in charge. And they were, from what I found out from Blonder after, it was almost like flipping a coin. So do we give up or do we, you know, stay and try to fight it out? And their decision was we're gonna fight it and see, you know, what happens. And as things turned out, on the seventh day, they got the 442nd to come in, and they lost a lot of men. A lot of men to get. We were about 220 of us, and they lost, oh, I don't know how many men wounded and captured and stuff to get through to us. But they finally got through to us on the seventh day.
I'm curious, you talk about the captain deciding whether or not to surrender. Have you ever wondered how your life would have been different if they had surrendered? And you think you'd still be here if they had surrendered and you guys would have become prisoners of war?
No, I don't know if the rumors were true or not, but from what we gathered, you didn't want to be a prisoner. You know, we thought, you know, how are you going to be treated? And if you got to the point where we lost the war, what would happen to us, you know, as prisoners of Germany? You know, it was just something that, you know, and after we even talked about it, says, hey, if it was like a thing where, okay, let's take a vote, I think that most of us were going to vote to fight, you know, fight or be captured or killed or whatever. But I think giving up was never an option.
Before I ask you about the 442nd and how indebted you feel to those guys, just tell me what it was like when you realized that someone had broken through, that you guys had a chance of being rescued. What were those moments like, and what kind of feeling was that for you?
Oh, I don't know. It was almost like being reborn, I think, because you don't know what to think. You know, while you're there and the way things are going, your mind is first on your family. You know, will I ever see them again? What will happen? How will they take it? You know, knowing that I'm never gonna come back. And it was just, I don't know, the feeling that we had, But then when we found out that they finally broke through, oh, man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know, because you figure it was 7 days of what we went through. And it was really hell up there because we couldn't really dig in deep because it was mountain, you know, and there was a lot of rock and stuff. You couldn't really dig a foxhole. And even if you did, the tree bursts, you had to worry about tree bursts, you know. When all of a sudden we heard one guy say, "Oh, my God, we're fighting the Japs." Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd. Mm-hmm. And yet they were attached to our division at times. Mm-hmm. But we didn't even know. And that's why that's one guy that made that remark. When we saw Japanese soldiers, oh, we're fighting the Japs. But then we found out they're our rescuers, and all we wanted to do was get out of there. And so we took off. I mean, we didn't stop to say thank you then or anything. All we wanted to do was get our butts off that mountain, and off we went.
He would have the opportunity to say thank you years later when a chance meeting with one of his rescuers would lead to a friendship that endured. You can hear more about that in the full original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when October arrives, keep your ears open for events commemorating the 75th anniversary of that rescue of the Lost Battalion. We're out of time for this edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping that this hour spent looking through the eyes of five men who 75 years ago this week were carrying out different roles in the often overlooked invasion of southern France serves as a reminder to you, as it does for me, that so many have sacrificed so much on our behalf. Or to say it a little more simply and directly, freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.